What does that look like? We recommend here in the United States about 700 grams. They were at 100 grams and said they wanted to go to half of that. So to get to 300 grams, they started to look at that the infrastructure needed to do that. There isn't any way. It was going to take an additional 36 million cows at our level of production here in the United States to produce half as much milk as we require in the U.S. That's the equivalent of about, I think, four U.S. herds, U.S. dairy herds to meet that demand. So it's a significant issue to address as this developing world comes into eating more more protein, more food protein. The second key right there is about choice. As we dive into that a little bit, this is really about the data. Because you hear, we used to hear a lot about the consumer just doesn't want technology in their food. So we got a little tired of hearing it and decided to go look and go ask them. So we did an in-depth study over a 10-year period of time, looking at data from over a 10-year period of time. Sorry, we called that the International Consumer Attitude Study. We started with over 70 studies of consumer buying behavior data. It's not a meta-analysis. It's not been peer-reviewed or published anywhere. But we did focus on, with the experts, two key areas to define this data set and screen this data set. And those were, one, you had to use unbiased questions. Basically, you can't use any leading questions. You had to provide an open-ended question with a free text answer. So really, what do they believe? And then you had to contrast that. Each study that was included in this analysis had to contrast that with what they actually do, which is where the spending data comes in. And so we started with 70 studies, combined those, looking at what they say they're going to do with what they actually do, where they put their money. And we narrowed that down, excluding several studies. We ended up with 28 studies. Across 26 countries and over 97,000 consumers between 2001 and 2010. So what did they tell us? They said that 95% of people are basically food buyers. They focus on three key criteria. Taste, cost, and nutrition were those three key criteria that they focused on. We had another 4% there that were considered lifestyle buyers. These are buyers that focus on a belief or a trait about food. It could be it's locally grown. It could be that they're vegetarians. It could be that they desire organic food. But that got us to 99%. You look at across all these groups, in particular the food buyers, they were either neutral or supportive of technology use in their food. And a lifestyle buyer, just to kind of give you an example, was not mutually exclusive of a food buyer. You may have somebody who is a food buyer for the majority of their grocery cart, but when it comes to wine, they might be a lifestyle buyer where price is less of an issue. So you kind of get an example there of how they're not mutually exclusive. So that's 99%. What about the other 1%? This was really the fringe. These are the people that we hear from. These are the people in the protest lines. These are the people that are amazingly cunning at making an impact. They can impact local, regional, even national media and legislation. They're out to make the bans. To put it simply, 99% of people care about what they eat. 1% of people care about what you and I eat, and they're worried about us. They're out to save us from ourselves, okay? And this 1%, primarily based off emotion and myth rather than facts. So when we look at this, what do we do with that information? Well, we need to pay attention to the 1%. We actually need to learn from them. These people very quickly go from commitment to conviction to action. And that's really what this is about. This is a call to action that we need to be just like them from the standpoint of getting committed, making this personal, and taking some action. There are things that we can do to influence our destiny here. We followed that study up with a secondary study to make sure we're continuing to head in the right direction. We surveyed over 26,000 households through the Nielsen Company. We found that 98% bought based on taste, cost, and nutrition. Those are still the three key factors. What about the lifestyle buyer? We need to pay attention to it. We need to make sure that we offer that choice, but we also need to keep it in perspective. It's a pretty small percentage of our business. If we look at food sales in the U.S., it's about 3% of sales that are produced without the use of technology. In Europe, it's about 2%. It's also not expected to increase a great deal over the next few years. An important niche, an important offering from a choice perspective, but not something that we need to get out of perspective. Look at a case study. Does technology really matter? Can it make an impact? We look at Brazil. They've made a very nice case study of within a generation, a country that's gone from a strict food importer to a major one of the largest food exporters. We look at some of the statistics in Brazil over the last 10 years, from 1996 to 2006, an over 300% increase in the value of their total crop production. They've grown their beef exports by 10 times, and they're now the world's largest exporters of beef, poultry, and sugarcane. So an example there of how that's been successful. What were the key criteria associated with that? A political climate that supported it. They had entrepreneurial leadership. They embraced the use of technology, and they had pro-agricultural policies. If we now compare that or contrast that with what people in this room might believe is one of the more restricted environments from a technology perspective, the lack of choice in Europe, where there's limited technology use, maybe also starting to turn the tide. We might see conventional beef from the U.S. shipped to Europe in my lifetime. This is quote from Paulo de Castro, who's the chairman of the European Parliament Committee on Agriculture. He said, "Farmers in the EU must be allowed to choose the tools they need to thrive, and our citizens must be free to select from the widest variety of food choices made possible by modern food production enterprises." So apply for choice and support for technology from the Agricultural Council in Europe. A positive sign that the message makes sense. Finally, sustainability. It's got to be environmentally right. Jason Clay, who runs the World Wildlife Fund, said to feed 9 billion people and maintain the planet, we've got to basically freeze the footprint of food. They calculate an interesting statistic. I think they call it the Earth Life Index. It says basically today, right now, we're at 1.3 times the carrying capacity of the Earth. And we're going to go from 7 billion to 9 billion in the next 40 years. So we've got to have technology, and the statistics support that we can do it. We've done it before. If you look at a lot of the recent work from Dr. Jude Capper, these are just some statistics. I'll click through these pretty quick to try to make up some time. Compared to 1944, 65% less water required to produce a gallon of milk, 90% less land, 76% less manure produced, resulting in a 63% smaller carbon footprint. When we look at the beef side of things, a pound of beef produced today versus 2007 versus 1977 is the years that she used. It's a 14% less water, 34% less land, 20% less manure produced, and an 18% smaller carbon footprint. So we can do it. We've done it before. Technology plays a key role in that. Let me wrap up here. Three key points. Food is a basic human right. It's the number one health problem in the world, and it's a real issue we need to address. We're going from 7 billion to 9 billion by the year 2050. We need 100% more food. We need to get there through technology and choice, and we're going to need the technology in order for the production of both technology-enhanced food as well as the right to choose. It's going to have to be sustainably right. What are we doing about it? This is five key areas where we've invested our people's time and our money to take this issue forward. Really, it's around technology and choice as a message. We're in communications like this across the country and in a number of our businesses. Social media, white papers, and editorials. We're focusing on engaging the top 500 key influencers in this area. We've built a team. We call it our food industry and consumer affairs team. That's all they do, is they're working on access, working with associations such as the U.S. Meat Export Federation, working in Washington, D.C. to help align and optimize the regulations and get access to these technologies around the world. The industry coalitions, working to gain one voice for safe, affordable food. And then the making it personal piece is really, it's really something that we're very passionate about. You can look at a number of issues that we're involved in. We're a large partner with Heifer International around the world, a goal to bring 100,000 families sustainably out of hunger. I talked about the initiatives in Indianapolis. We also give our employees one day a quarter of off time just to go do initiatives such as this. And then finally, it's about bringing that new innovation. We've changed our innovation model significantly in the last 5 to 7 years to bring enhanced innovation from a quantity, quality, and speed of innovation standpoint. And finally, it's your turn. There's always a now what challenge for you guys is to make it personal. If you're in a bubble, get out of it. Go see what hunger looks like. Engage the food chain. You guys are part of it. Go share this message. It's available for your use. And finally, support the 99%. I really appreciate the opportunity. If you guys would like more information, we've got a blog. It's called plentytothinkabout.org. You can get all this information. I believe the white paper is in the proceedings as well. And there's a short video out there as well. Thank you very much.